I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour is the author of a very important and extremely well-written book, Bending Toward Justice, the Voting Rights Act and the Transformation of American Democracy. There are lots of striking pictures in this book, and one stands out for me, Hattiesburg, Mississippi in 1964, two African-American gentlemen who are attempting to vote. And in 10 days, there's a sign above them that says the names and addresses, their names and addresses, and all who are attempting to register to vote will be published in the local newspaper, giving opponents of black suffrage a chance to retaliate against them. And a lot of this book is about the incredibly disturbing retaliation that took place and the attempts to get everybody the right to vote. Nearly impossible obstacles to overcome, our guest writes, in the South. Poll taxes, literacy taxes, hostile registrars. If a person succeeded and was allowed to vote, the name was published, alerting his employers and others equally determined to stop him. Black men and women who dared to vote lost their jobs, their homes, and often their lives. Gary May is our guest this hour. He's a professor of history at the University of Delaware, and he is author of several books on post-war American history. He's joined us before, and we have so much to talk about this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, please leave messages there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And Gary May, thank you very much for being with us. What an important book this is. What strikes me is that we just forget that this history, and it's so important to always remember it, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's an incredible story, almost unbelievable that this could go on for so long in the United States of America.
Yes, it is. You start, and I don't know very much about this time period, and I'd like for you to inform us, please. You start with part of the book is about radical Reconstruction early on, which did bring Southern blacks political freedom, and how they embraced it, how many people were elected to office, when this happened, and then what happened. Can you let us know about that, please?
Sure. Obviously, with the Northern victory in the Civil War, Reconstruction came to the South. African Americans were briefly allowed the right to vote. They embraced it enthusiastically. Many served in posts in state government, jobs like tax assessors, even local sheriffs in some places. They sent a few members to the United States Congress, and even two were members of the United States Senate. Unfortunately, Reconstruction ended, and the old Southern governments resumed power. And about the first thing they did was to create new constitutions which set out to specifically exclude African Americans from voting. And while Reconstruction probably didn't end completely until around 1900, 1901, it's from that point on that, as you described, all of these tests were now employed. Literacy tests, poll taxes, plus physical intimidation, economic intimidation, and they would really last until the 1965 Voting Rights Act.
Mm-hmm. So as you say, it was a struggle for almost, and it's a struggle that continues, 100 years in the making. 100 years.
Yes. I mean, it's no surprise that these obstacles succeeded for so long. Just consider you described that photograph alerting new voters to the news that their names are going to be published in the newspaper. That was the least of it. They would go down to the registrar's office. Very often, the registrars weren't even there. Their hours weren't always posted. They weren't open regularly. They'd often arrive late. They would leave early. African Americans who came there were, of course, put in a separate room. They had to fill out a 3-page application. And if they made the slightest error, they would immediately be rejected. Then there was an oral exam. And some of the questions a Harvard PhD could answer. I mean, for example, one of the questions used was, name all of the county judges in Alabama.
Oh, my gosh.
There were 67.
Oh, my gosh.
And also, they were asked questions, and for example, they had to copy a section of the Alabama State Constitution, but they were dictated. The passages were dictated, and actually, I have in front of me here, white people who went in, for example, were asked to copy. They didn't have to have it dictated to them. A section of the Constitution, one sentence, and here it is, that no person shall be imprisoned for debt. And then they were asked to interpret it. Now, when an African-American would have to write down a passage dictated by the registrar, it was like this, and I'll just be very brief. The income arising from the 16th section trust fund, the surplus revenue fund, until it is called for by the United States government, and the funds enumerated in section... Yeah, should I go on?
No, but yes, please, finish it. I want to hear it. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it's no surprise that, for example, in 1962, about 57% of African Americans in Selma were eligible to vote, and only 1% of them had succeeded.
Yeah. Before we talk about the heroes here and how politically all of this got fashioned, what role JFK, what role LBJ, what role Martin Luther King, et cetera, please tell me why it is that all of this incredibly obvious injustice existed for an intimidation existed in this country without for such a long period of time without everybody saying, wait a second, this is very wrong.
Well, you know, we forget that we live in an age where information is very easily available. Mm. Of course, for much of the 20th century, that wasn't true. You know, prior to what, the 1920s, you didn't have radio. And not till the 1950s did you have television, which, and we can talk about this later as well, proved to be invaluable to the civil rights movement. So the South was able to live really as almost a separate country. Southern newspapers, for example, carried no information about their black citizens. There were black newspapers, of course, all over the country, but again, they were not reaching white audiences. And African Americans, especially in the South, had absolutely no power. So, you know, it was a hidden history, really.
Let's talk about who started to shake things up. Some of these people that you write about were so incredibly brave, weren't they? I mean, just so brave. I think every time I look at the face of John Lewis, I think about how brave he was.
Yeah.
So let's highlight some of these people. And this is a person who's gone pretty much unnoticed, Bernard Lafayette, 21-year-old member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, one of the founding fathers of the Voting Rights Act. Tell us his story.
You know, that was what was so fascinating for me writing the book. There are many founding fathers and mothers, among whom is Bernard Lafayette. At 21, 22, he was already a veteran civil rights worker, part of the Nashville sit-in movement in 1960, a freedom rider in 1961. By 1962, he'd already seen probably the inside of more jails than career criminals.
Mm.
In the summer of 1962, he was looking for a new assignment, and he went to SNCC headquarters in Atlanta, and he met with his boss, James Foreman, and they went over to a map on the wall that showed where SNCC people were active in many things, and particularly in recruiting for voting. And in one part of Alabama, there is a huge X, and Lafayette inquires, what's the X? And Foreman said, that's Dallas County and Selma, its county seat.
Huh.
it's hopeless. We've given up on Selma. Blacks are just too scared for obvious reasons, and the white people are too mean. And Lafayette replies, that's where I want to go. I want that challenge. And so he goes. And actually took his bride with him, Colia Lafayette, who thought Selma was an awfully strange place for a honeymoon.
I would imagine.
Yeah. But they had allies there. There was a couple, Sam and Amelia Boynton, who also deserve to be known as founding fathers of the Voting Rights Act. They had been active since the 1930s, trying to improve the lives of Selma's citizens. And by the time that Lafayette arrived early in 1963, Sam Boynton's business had been ruined because of his activities and his health. He'd had several strokes, and he was confined to a nursing home. And Lafayette met with him, and he could see how ill Boynton was, but the passion for voting still burned brightly. People would come by to see Sam Boynton. He, first thing he would say is, are you registered? A voteless people is a hopeless people. And Lafayette was extraordinarily inspired by Sam Boynton. He sensed that Boynton was kind of passing the torch for voting rights to him. And so Lafayette set out to do his work, and he faced a number of obstacles. Some of them, I think, for Caucasians, might be surprising. For example, he met resistance in the black community. Poor black people in Selma simply could not believe that voting could possibly improve their lives. Then there were the professional black community, the teachers, the clergymen, who had made a kind of separate peace with segregationists. After all, for teachers, they were dependent for their jobs on white school boards. So people told Lafayette, we really don't want you here. This is someone's going to have their head blown off.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in addition to resistance from the black community, you have segregationists who are not happy that he's there. And of course, the radical fringe of that group, the Ku Klux Klan, which is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So what Lafayette did very cleverly was to turn to those people who had energy and less to lose, young people.
Mm-hmm.
He recruited people from Selma University as well as the local high schools. And they proved to be very helpful. I mean, high school students could say to their government teachers, how can you teach me government when you can't vote? And they'd work on their parents, too. So slowly, Lafayette begins to build a foundation for a voting rights movement in Selma at very grave risk himself.
He almost gets his head blown off, right?
That's exactly right. I mean, their phone was tapped. When they called SNCC headquarters, they would use a different name, but the operator would often break in and say, I know who you are, Mrs. Lafayette, and I know where you are, too. They drove very slowly so that the police could not pull them over for breaking the speed limit.
Hmm.
They checked out their rearview mirror to see that they weren't being followed. And they watched for cars they didn't recognize parked near their apartment. And one night, as you've noted, June 11th, 1963, Lafayette comes home after a meeting. And there in front of his apartment is a car with its hood up and a man looking down into it, another man behind the wheel. And Lafayette wonders, well, is this the moment that I've kind of been expecting, or is it just a stranded motorist? Gets out of his car, the man approaches him, white man approaches him and said, I'm having trouble getting my car started. Could you give me a push? Could you pull your car behind my car? And Lafayette kind of sighs with relief. Okay, it's just a guy who can't get his car moving. Pulls his car behind the other car. The white man says, I don't think your bumper is close enough. Could you check it out? Lafayette gets out, looks, and as he looks back up, he is clubbed in the head with a pistol held by the white man. Down he goes to the ground, but his movement training immediately kicks in. He's been taught in the nonviolent movement that you act unexpectedly. You don't beg for your life. You don't run away. You try to touch some humanity in your attacker. So Lafayette gets to his feet. He stares down his attacker, who hits him again. Down Lafayette goes again. He's bleeding by now. Gets back up, continues to stare down the man. By this time, people are coming outside from nearby apartments. The man gets in his car and runs away, drives away. Lafayette goes to the hospital. He needs something like 10 stitches, I think, to close his head wound. Stays overnight in the hospital. Next morning, doesn't go home to clean himself up, change his blood-stained shirt. No, he goes back in the streets, and he runs into a friend named J.L. Chestnut, who was the first black lawyer in Selma. And Chestnut said, "My God, you look terrible. Go home, clean up, change your clothes." And Lafayette says, "No, this is the symbol that we need, that we're not going to be thrown out, kicked out of this town. We're going to fight here until we get the right to vote."
I'm such a young man. Selma figures so prominently in your book, and I'm wondering if this was really a turning point, going ahead a couple years to Selma in March 7th, 1965, remember this bloody Sunday, state troopers and local vigilantes brutally attack those who want to register to vote. The event, you say, touched the conscience of a nation. I want to know about the role of that event forcing. Did it force Johnson to put a voting rights bill at the front of his agenda, his political agenda? And what was the role of the press? Because I think it was substantial in putting this in the minds of American people.
Absolutely. What's so fascinating about that event is that it almost didn't take place. You have to back up just a little bit, and I'll try to be brief. Obviously, this story just captured me completely, so I could talk for hours about it. King comes to Selma in January 1965. The movement gets going, but it does not create that moment, that event, that King hopes will touch the conscience of the nation. And so he's actually considering pulling out of Selma. But what happens is, in a nearby town in Perry County named Marion, another group of churchgoers, civil rights workers among them, are brutally attacked by Selma state troopers, local police. One young man named Jimmy Lee Jackson is killed in the melee that followed. And the people of Marion County are so upset by this, they want to take his body and dump it on the steps of the Capitol where George Wallace resided. And it's from that event that this March 7th march evolves. About 600 civil rights workers, many of them from Marion County, are going to start marching from Selma to Montgomery. Now, they don't really plan to go all the way to Montgomery. It's a five-day march. They think they're just going to get arrested and spend a night in jail. Well, they get to the Edmund Pettus Bridge. They're confronted by this mass, of a sea of blue, Lewis later said. Alabama state troopers, local police, many of the troopers on horseback. They're armed with not only with guns, but bats wrapped in barbed wire, tear gas, and they are brutally attacked. John Lewis is struck in the head. As he falls to the ground, he says to himself, as he later wrote in his memoir, "I'm going to die here." Amelia Boynton, she too is struck and falls and is very badly beaten. Someone calls for an ambulance, and one of the orchestrators of this event, the brutal sheriff of Dallas County, Jim Clark, replies, "Ambulance, let the buzzards eat them." Also there covering that event were the news cameras of ABC, CBS, and NBC. And it was really ABC who broke the story in a major way. They get filmed to New York that Sunday night, March 7th. And the producers there decide to interrupt the regularly scheduled programming, which happened to be a film called Judgment at Nuremberg.
Yes, about
the Nazi war trial.
Oh, my.
Yeah, and they just showed the raw footage, about 15 minutes, no narration. And this struck the country like never before. People, thousands of people, rushed to Selma to join King's movement. Others traveled to Washington, kind of besiege Lyndon Johnson. Now, Lyndon Johnson had been sympathetic to a voting rights bill, but he was concerned that the country was not quite ready. Just the previous July in 1964, he had signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, left from John Kennedy's administration, which desegregated public accommodations, hotels, motels, restaurants. And he feared that to send another civil rights bill so soon might divide the Congress, might endanger his other programs which were so dear to his heart, education, Medicare. But Bloody Sunday changed everything. And now Johnson decides that he's got to send a bill to the Congress.
Hmm. And what about... I'm sorry.
On March 15th, he speaks to the Congress, a joint session of the Congress, and that's probably the greatest speech of his presidency because he explains to the Congress, bill is coming, and he ends that speech by saying, we shall overcome,
right,
invoking the very words of the Civil Rights anthem. And it was an extraordinary moment, and the bill comes to the Congress thereafter.
He was also one very savvy politician. What about the meeting between Dr. Martin Luther King and Lyndon Johnson, where King tells him, hey, listen, you might be able to get more votes out of the South, too, if you have African-Americans voting. Was that influential or not?
I think it was, yes, it was somewhat influential. I mean, King could be as clever a politician in his own way as Lyndon Johnson was, because Lyndon Johnson knew, after the passage of the 1964 Act, he was being congratulated by one of his aides, and he said, yes, it's a great moment in our history, but, you know, I think we just lost the South for a long time to come. So part of Johnson hoped that by bringing the vote to African Americans in the South, that they would, you know, support the Democratic Party, replacing the solid South, which the Democrats could always rely on.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you. Professor Gary May is our guest this hour. His book is Bending Toward Justice, the Voting Rights Act and the Transformation of American Democracy. He's a professor of history at the University of Delaware. We will eventually move into 2013, but we got a little to cover before we get to 2013 because, as you know, the Supreme Court is dealing with the Voting Rights Act in the month of June, and we will ask Gary May about the section of the act that they are looking at and the ramifications for voting in this country, depending on how they rule. All right? So join us. I'm sure that some of you probably have some stories of ancestors who tried to register to vote, or maybe even stories, some of you who traveled to the South to join the civil rights movement and decided to fight for voting rights, for civil rights. We'd like to hear all of your stories as well. So here's how you reach us. Again, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome phone calls for our guest. 800-486-8655 is the number. Again, the email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. His book is Bending Toward Justice, The Voting Rights Act, and the Transformation of American Democracy. We welcome your thoughts on this, and you can move us into 2013 as well, because the Supreme Court will be looking at this issue. As phone calls, and there are many of them coming in, just a quick question for you, Professor Gary May, about John Fitzgerald Kennedy. We hear conflicting views as to whether or not he embraced, really, the civil rights movement. I was interested in a little thing in the book that said that in terms of Voting Rights Act, is this right that he wanted to have a sixth grade education requirement for African Americans?
Yes. Yes. Kennedy really came late to a strong commitment to the civil rights movement. We tend to forget that Kennedy was very narrowly elected, and so he needed to move cautiously as president at home. Furthermore, the Congress was dominated by Southerners. They chaired all of the important committees. If a bill wanted to get a rule before it went to the floor or to a committee, it had to go to the House Rules Committee, and that was dominated by Judge Howard Smith of Virginia, who could tie up and did tie up any piece of civil rights legislation. So Kennedy, well, sympathetic, and I think Bob Kennedy was even more sympathetic because he sent to the South a number of Justice Department workers to investigate voting rights abuses, and they worked very hard. For the president, he had to wait till, like LBJ, for that moment to come, and it came in Birmingham in the spring of 1963 when Bull Connor let loose his police dogs and his fire hoses on demonstrators. And actually, the same night that Bernard Lafayette is attacked in Selma, June 11, 1963, President Kennedy announces to the nation on television that he's going to send a civil rights bill to the Congress. And it's the most impassioned speech that John Kennedy ever gave in civil rights. He said, those who do nothing are inviting shame. We can't say to the world, and more importantly to ourselves, that we are the land of the free, except, as he said, for the Negro, that we have no class or master race except for the Negro. Time has come. We've talked about civil rights for 100 years in this country. It's time for us to act.
Let's go to some phone calls. Bobby in Barnum. Hi, Bobby.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Oh, I didn't hear you call my name.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm from Austin, Minnesota, and lived in Atlanta for 32 years, and I had dated a black man and ended up having crosses burned in my front yard. And this was in the late 70s, early 80s. And then another experience I found very unusual when we lived in an area that was probably 99% black, and my husband and I are both white, and I was fighting airport noise because they always had airport noise more in the, you know, minority areas, poor areas. And I would go around and knock on doors to get people to sign this petition, and they were very wary of me. And I still have a friend down there. She's actually a tenant of mine, but she's a dear friend. And I still hate that she seems to think that she is not as worthy as I am. And I, even though I've tried to tell her, it's just ingrained. And it's still going on. My husband and I have jokingly said Lincoln should have just let him secede from the nation. It is a different world down there.
Do you think it still is, Gary May?
That's one of the central questions here. Chief Justice Roberts says, we are now a different nation.
Mm-hmm.
African-Americans can vote freely and in large numbers, obviously, without the physical intimidation or economic intimidation they experienced in the 50s and 60s. And he's partly correct. Yes, we are, I think, a better nation. But there's no question that, and especially in those states that are covered by the Voting Rights Act, that racism still exists. Now, I don't know if you, Kevin, if you want to talk about the Shelby County case at this
yes,
moment?
Yes, let's do that, sure.
Okay. Well, you know, Shelby County is the worst possible place to bring a challenge to the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act, and especially to its most powerful provision, Section 5. Now, Section 5 requires that those states, there are nine of them that are covered completely, and parts of seven other states, which have had a history of very bad abuses in voting because of race. In Shelby County, there is a town called Calera. Calera decided that they would, the city council decided they would redraw their voting districts. And they submitted them to the Justice Department, as is required by Section 5. The Justice Department said, no, this is not acceptable, because your redrawn map will exclude the area that which is represented by the single African-American city councilman. Mm. Well, Calera went ahead anyway and held the election, and sure enough, the African-American was defeated, mm-hmm. and the Justice Department came in and said, you have got to hold the election again, and you've got to redraw your map to include the black community. They were forced to do it. They did it. They held the election. The African-American councilman won his seat. So, yes, things are better, but there is still, especially in the states of the Deep South, strong racial hostility.
Well, I'm wondering how Section 5, and I believe that you reference a case in Texas somehow, that Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act has also been used to challenge particularly onerous voter ID legislation.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, if it has occurred in the those states or sections of other states outside the South that are covered by the Act. That's one of the important things about Section 5. It not only can it strike down these most kind of egregious proposals, it acts as a deterrent. States who are covered by Section 5 know they have to come up with a system that is just, that is not tainted by racism. So Section 5 really deters them from many of the worst excesses of the past.
But Section 5 would have a harder time pointing to Section 5 in states that are outside that purview of those states that you mentioned, the seven other states.
Yes. There is another provision of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, which does apply nationally, but the system works differently. There, private lawsuits have to be employed. In other words, under Section 5, an area is prevented from enacting a racially tainted program, whether it's voter ID or gerrymandering. But under Section 2, you have to wait until that bad act occurs, and then you have to sue. The burden of proof is not on the area, as it is under Section 5, but under those who bring the lawsuit under Section 2. So that's why Section 5 remains so important.
Yeah. Bobby, thanks for the call. Ross in Madison. Hi, Ross.
Hi. I grew up in Wisconsin. I lived in South Carolina for a while. The question I have is sometimes I feel like as Northerners we have kind of a sort of this righteous indignation, this thought of how could these Southerners do this? But I'm wondering from the guest is could he hold this discussion down in South Carolina? If there was public radio down there, I mean there's public radio, but I mean can they have this discussion? I know they have a lot of black colleges, and I'm sure this discussion is held there. But what does he feel like within the general population that they are willing to even have this conversation about this situation? Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Russ.
Well, I think the conversation would be had in certainly in the black schools in South Carolina, but I'm not sure it would go on anywhere elsewhere. After all, South Carolina was one of the first states to the first state to challenge the Voting Rights Act originally in 1965, and was also in 2011 and 12. One of the places where voter IDs were promoted. But because it is a covered state by the Voting Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act was able to prevent changes in their voting practices.
So you're saying that your wonderfully written history here would have a hard time finding its way in high school classrooms in the South?
I would hope it would find its way if there were teachers who truly appreciated history. I guess it was Daniel Patrick Moynihan, famous U.S. senator and former college professor, who said, "You know, you're entitled to your interpretation or." Your point of view, but you're not entitled to your own facts.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the role of teachers, and I would hope that the book could find its way there. You know, the more rural sections of the South, there was just a piece on, I think, NBC News about one of the segregated proms in a rural part
yes.
of Georgia. Rural part of Georgia.
Yeah.
You know, you'd think in 2013 this would be unheard of. And in the most rural sections, I think, of the South, not all that much has changed.
Hmm. Martha in Milwaukee. Hi, Martha.
Hi, good morning. What a great discussion. A couple points here. I'm from Milwaukee originally, but I live in Mobile, Alabama. I'm actually a history professor at the University of South Alabama. And addressing the points of the last two callers, you know, certainly there are grinding problems with regard to race in the South, but this sense that in the quote-unquote North, it may be different or more receptive to these conversations, I think is not really accurate. If we look at Milwaukee, it's one of the most hyper-segregated cities in the country. And racism has been present throughout all the states from the very beginning. It just took shape differently in the South. And at our university, which is about 80% white, 20% African American, which is larger than the national average in terms of African-American student population. We have conversations like this a lot, and they're also open to the community. So I think that there are, you know, equal numbers of people in both the South and outside of the South who are willing and not willing to have this conversation. So that's one point. The other point for the professor is that the little-known Freedom Summer of 1965, where hundreds of college students went down into the Deep South to knowing that the Voting Rights Bill would be coming up and passing to get African Americans to register to vote and to make sure that that those processes were happening. And I was just wondering if the if your guest could comment on that. And there's actually going to be a book coming out early next year by Maria Gittin, This Bright Light of Ours, that talks about her experiences in that Freedom Summer movement as a volunteer, as well as the stories from oral histories of African Americans living in Wilcox County, Alabama. So some of your listeners might be interested in that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Martha.
Yes. I mean, Freedom Summer was actually the summer of 1964, not 65, was very important. It was a movement where African-American civil rights workers in Mississippi brought to Mississippi white college students primarily from the East and California. And, of course, the events there led to one of the great tragedies of the civil rights movement, the murder of the three civil rights workers in the so-called Mississippi burning case. I focused on Selma because that is usually seen as ground zero of the voting rights movement. I mean, I don't mean to discount the importance of Freedom Summer, but the way it turned out, King chose to go not to Mississippi in 1965, but to Selma, Alabama.
Yes.
In 1965.
Yeah.
So I'm glad to hear of the new book coming out. I've read some of the woman's work on her blog, and the more we know about history, the happier I am.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's the case. Yeah, I want you to mention John Doerr as well. He's in your book, and he's from Wisconsin. It took people to really go down.
Yes.
And have their eyes open by actually being there, right?
You know, John Doerr is truly one of the great men of American history, and I suspect that most of your audience, through no fault of their own, has never heard of him. A Republican from Wisconsin who joins the Justice Department in the final days of the Eisenhower administration. He's kind of bored with his sort of family law practice in Wisconsin, and decides, he doesn't know how long he's going to stay. He's a Republican. John Kennedy's been elected, but he does stay. And John Doerr is a very kind of restless guy. He preferred not to be office bound, and so he goes to the South, and he really becomes educated, almost radicalized in the sense of he goes to one church. It may have been in South Carolina, I can't remember. And everyone in the church has been, there were tenant farmers, and they were all kicked off off the farm, lost their jobs because they had tried to register to vote. And he just decided that something had to be done about this. And he would try to build lawsuits against the registrars in these states. And it proved to be such a torturous process. It took such a long time to get witnesses who would testify in local courts presided over by hostile judges. And very often, these cases would drag on for years, and when the case finally came up, the registrars who the suit was against had quit. And so the judge had no one to hold the case against. So he's in the book quite a bit because he goes to Alabama to supervise the Great Voting Rights March from Selma to Montgomery from March 21st to 25th. There's some concern that Martin Luther King might be assassinated. King is urged to get out of the final march. King refuses, and John Doerr and one of his aides, a U.S. Marshal, sort of goes far in the distance ahead of the march looking for assassins lurking in buildings. They don't find anyone. And then finally, something that I wrote about not only in the book but in a piece that's coming out in the NAACP magazine called The Crisis in June. In 1966, the terrible sheriff of Dallas County in Selma, Jim Clark, who orchestrated Bloody Sunday, is running for re-election. And his opponent is a white man who is a segregationist, but he's a decent police professional. Clearly, someone that the black community is supporting. And Jim Clark discovers that he's going to lose, and he tries to steal the election.
Hmm.
And it's John Doerr who steps in and, using the Voting Rights Act, brings a lawsuit against Clark and Clark's supporters. Dorr wins the lawsuit, and it really ends Jim Clark's career.
It is a story worth knowing about. More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is the author of Bending Toward Justice, the Voting Rights Act, and the Transformation of American Democracy. Gary May traces the history of the Voting Rights Act from the creation during the heyday of the Civil Rights era to the challenges that its provisions face today. 800-486-8655. Time for a couple more phone calls in a moment. Here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Short period of time left. Let's try and take a few calls. Sue in Madison, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. I thought you asked an excellent question earlier in the conversation when you asked how are we able to ignore the kinds of racial discrepancies that we've seen. I'd like to rephrase that and ask, how are we able to ignore the kinds of huge racial discrepancies in incarceration rates, which have the effect of disenfranchising minority populations, as well as ignoring current efforts to enforce voter ID laws and other efforts in the North that have the effect of disenfranchising minorities?
Gary May.
As for felons, for example, who have served their time, many of them have encountered difficulty registering to vote under new voter restrictions. Most prominently in Florida, Jeb Bush had pushed through a fairly liberal bill allowing those who had served their sentences and paid the price, and but when the current governor came in, Rick Scott, that was completely reversed. So that is an ongoing struggle. Voter IDs. We were successful in the period 2011-2012 in dealing, and certainly in the covered states, with some of those. But that's a struggle that is continuing. For example, voter IDs are now pending in some 30 states. So, there's been some talk about nationalizing the Voting Rights Act so that it does deal with racism throughout the country, as your earlier caller noted, and that was an excellent point. We'll see. It all depends on how the court rules in a couple of weeks, I guess. Whether Section 5 will be struck down and whether it goes back to the Congress and what the Congress will be confronted with. Will this Congress, so dominated by the Tea Party, reject any kind of revision of Section 5 if that's what the court orders? I wrote in a piece for Salon.com that I thought Republicans would have it would be difficult for Republicans to say no to a revised Voting Rights Act, and someone online said I was delusional that this Congress would. But I guess I'm a little more hopeful. I think that certainly if Republicans want to survive as a party, they're going to have to stop suppressing the vote, stop blocking the emergence of a more multi-ethnic and multiracial society, and accommodate themselves to it.
Yeah, it's happening. We're almost out of time. You write, and I just love this this King quote, he is referencing a quote from the 19th century abolitionist Theodore Parker. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you believe this, after doing all of this work and thinking about the future, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Do you think that's true?
I think it's true, but I also like what President Obama has added to that quote. He said, quote, "Here's the thing, that arc doesn't turn unless we all put our hands on that arc and move it in the direction of justice."
Hmm. Gary May, thank you. You've written just a splendid book. It's so important, and thank you again for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Gary May, our guest this hour. The book is Bending Toward Justice, The Voting Rights Act, and the Transformation of American Democracy. He is a professor of history at the University of Delaware and has written several other books as well. I think we talked to him a couple of years ago about, well, I know we did, about one of his other books. So, thanks to Rhonda Fanning and to KP Whaley for producing and doing on-air production for this particular program. Great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network, and we'll be with you again tomorrow at 9. Thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network.